The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
This is the first event for Shanghai Girls, so I haven't spoken about it yet. I don't know what I'm doing, so this will be an adventure for both of us. You know, I have some ideas of what I want to talk about, but I haven't, you know, timed it or any of those things. First, though, before I start talking about the book, I want to say that I was out there earlier signing some books for people in advance, and it's so wonderful for me when I go to an event like this and I get to meet people that I've only talked to through the internet. I have a website, and there's a place that says Write Lisa, and people write to me, and I answer every single email. And sometimes, you know, I answer, and somebody else answers back, and I write back, and they write back, and you go back and forth. And pretty soon, somebody sent, you know, that person says, "Well, I know you're not Lisa, but whoever you are, you're very nice." And I, you know, it really is me. I'm just sitting in my nightgown typing in the morning. So tonight, there's some people that I have met before, you know, because they've come to other events through because of we'd already known each other in the internet. But there's also someone here tonight who has come who I also met on the internet, but in a different way. And I'm going to get to that story later because it sort of actually works into what I wanted to talk about tonight. When I've talked about my books in the past, if you've heard me before, I've usually talked about stories that have been lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up. And also quite a bit about my family and the Chinese side of my family. I'm not going to stray too far from that again tonight, because this new book really embraces both of those things once again, stories that have been lost, forgotten, or deliberately covered up. And in many ways, this book is probably the closest to my own family's experience, except for On Gold Mountain, which is actually about the family. So I'm not going to stray too far from that, but I am going to talk about this sense of writing what you know. Every writer is told, write what you know. And if you've read some of my other books, you know that how I couldn't possibly know about the secret writing in China or women writers in the 17th century or the Chinese version of the afterlife or I know there's some mystery readers here, you know, how the China's version of the FBI operates in China and the theft of artifacts and searching for bear gallbladders and all of that. Well, guess what? On the surface, I know nothing about those things. But I do a lot of research and I go to China and pretty soon, after a couple of years, I actually know that stuff. But to me, that's not what my books are about. The sort of super official stories of, you know, in the history. To me, what they're about are relationships and emotions. And so relationships like mothers and daughters, sisters, husbands and wives, having kids and the relationships that you have with your children and what happens as they grow older. Those emotions like love and envy and regrets and jealousy and joy. These are things I know very well, just as you know them very well, because we experience them in our lives. When I'm writing, I try to put everything I know right up to this day, right now, into the books. And for me, sometimes when I don't do this very often, but about 2 years ago, my publisher re-released my mysteries. And I hadn't looked at them in years. And they came and they had these really pretty new jackets. And I couldn't help it. I flipped through them. And when I flipped through them, I could remember exactly where I was when I wrote these particular scenes. So, you know, people are dying and people are getting shot. And, you know, there are these helicopter chases and things like that. But what I was thinking about was, oh, I can remember my husband was so upset with me. or I remember that Alexander, my son, was going through this tough time, or that Chris had his heart broken by that nasty, terrible Jesse. That all of that emotion that I'd been experiencing in my life makes its way into the books. And so in so many ways, they are actually very autobiographical, even though on the surface they have nothing to do with my life. They are very autobiographical because they are about these experiences and emotions and relationships that I experience in my own life. So, Shanghai Girls. What I want to do is I'm going to tell you the plot. We're going to talk a little bit about the history and then sort of dig down into these deeper emotions. And I sort of am thinking about this as a little bit like a little archaeological dig. So here's the plot. It's the first book I've ever written that I can do in one sentence. It's about two sisters who leave Shanghai in 1937 and go to Los Angeles, Chinatown, and arranged marriages. We could all go home right now, you know. It's about this immigrant experience that we all of us share in, that we all of us in this room have someone in our lives, in our families, who was crazy enough, brave enough, scared enough to leave their home countries to come here. And what does it mean to become American? What do we bring with us? And what do we abandon? What do we leave behind? This is something that we all share in, and so that's very much a part of this story. But here are some layers of history. Shanghai Girls, it's called Shanghai Girls, right? And Shanghai is where it starts in 1937. And Shanghai at that time, it was the Paris of Asia. It was glamorous, it was modern, it was a place of warlords and beggars and very stuffy English and beautiful girls, these young women who used to be the models in on posters and all kinds of, every kind of advertising you could imagine. They advertised cigarettes. They advertised bug spray. They advertised perfume. They advertised baby formula. All of these things. And they did it in such a way that sometimes they were posed playing tennis or getting on and off an airplane or driving cars or sitting in their boudoirs with, you know, just a little bit of filmy fabric on them, looking very, what would you say? Sexy, I think, is the word. All of these, no matter what they were doing, whether they were being active or dressed up and out on the town or out dancing or lounging in their baths, the whole idea was to sell this modern woman who was gorgeous, brilliant, thin, beautifully dressed, beautiful hair and makeup, could smoke a cigarette, was kind of ballsy, you know, but also as bettable as possible. And this, you know, and even today, this is the way to sell a product, right? So it's, you know, it's not that much has changed. And I was so curious about what it was like for these young women. What were their lives like? And I've been collecting Shanghai poster art for about 15 years. And I have a poster in my bedroom, which when I wake up, you know, I sleep on my left side. When I wake up, there it is. And it's these two beautiful girls sitting together on perched on a chair. And their complexions are rosy, and they just look, you know, you just want to lick them. They're so pretty. And all around them are these dead bugs falling down. You know, in this beautiful room, all these dead bugs just, you know, all over the poster because it's an ad for bug spray. And so here they are smiling so sweetly, but one of them is holding one of those, you know. And it's working because all the bugs are, you know, and I've looked at that thing for years and years and years, and finally I want to write about them. I want to know what their lives were like. So Pearl and May, they leave Shanghai at this moment when it's at its absolute apex, because as soon as they leave, it's when the Japanese invade, and after that there will be civil war, and after that the communists will take over, and so Shanghai really won't come back again until really beginning in about 1990. So it's, you know, for about, it's this last moment before 70 years of gray despair in that city. When they leave Shanghai, they come to the United States, and they have to pass through Angel Island. Have any of you heard of Angel Island? Angel Island was the Ellis Island of the West. We tend to think of Ellis Island as, you know, it wasn't easy to go through, but it was more or less a welcoming place. You passed by the Statue of Liberty. You came through, you know, think of the hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people who came from Europe through Ellis Island, and then they were able to get here to America. And yes, they had their questions, and yes, they had their medical tests, but it was nothing like Angel Island. Angel Island's whole purpose was to keep the Chinese out. It was seen as the Western guardian of, I'm sorry, the guardian of the Western Gate. It was to just keep primarily Chinese, but over time it would also become Japanese and other people who were coming from across the Pacific out of the country. In 1882, the United States had passed the Chinese Exclusion Act that had barred the immigration of all Chinese immigrants except for four categories: diplomats, merchants, students, and ministers. Ministers. There's only one that you can fake, and that's a merchant. And so they were really trying to keep out anyone who was coming in as a fake merchant, anyone who was coming in as a paper son, and finally, anyone who was just trying to sneak in as a laborer. So at Ellis Island, they asked about 20 standard questions. At Angel Island, it was between 200 and 1,000 standard questions. The questions were difficult. Things like, and just think about if somebody asked you this today, how many steps to your front door? How many trees between your house and the corner? How many windows are on the house across the street? Questions that were designed to trick people into making mistakes. If they made mistakes, these interrogations, they were called hearings, but they actually, in fact, were interrogations, could go on for weeks and months, and in some cases, even years. There was a lot of suicide and a lot of people who were deported back to China. And I had a lot of my own family pass through Angel Island, and the scenes in Shanghai Girls are taken almost verbatim from the interrogations of my great grandfather's fake people he was bringing in. So, you know, someone who shouldn't have been here, his illegal wife. But I have all of those papers, and I was able to look at those confessions, her interview, and really look at it and use it. So they finally make their way out of Angel Island, and they go down to Los Angeles. And in Los Angeles, at that time, there were four Chinatowns. One of them was called China City. China City was supposed to be this authentic Chinese city. It was invented by a Caucasian woman. And it was one square block surrounded by a miniature Great Wall, and inside it was built from the leftover sets from the filming of The Good Earth. So it was a place with a lot of charm. You could ride a rickshaw. You take a ride in a rickshaw. You could, one of the specialties was China Burger. You could have a China Burger. You could go to the pirate ship cafe and drink pirate grog. So there was a lot to recommend it, but the one thing it wasn't was authentic. And here's where these two sisters end up. And I was really interested in looking at that idea of what's Chinese, what's authentic. You know, if you're in Shanghai, the Paris of Asia, and then you come to this sort of fake China that's supposed to be authentic China, and what does that even mean? And then finally, the last layer of history would be the confession program. And the confession program began in the 1950s. It was when our government targeted Chinese who had come here as paper sons illegally, you know, claiming false citizenship because they said that they had a father who was born here. And they had bought a piece of paper that said, you know, your father was born in America, so you are a citizen. And what the confession program did was it was targeting these Chinese citizens, asking them to confess that they had come here illegally. And while they were at it, if they could just rat out their friends, their neighbors, their business associates, their own family members. And along the way, if they could just, you know, bring themselves to mention that someone might be a communist, then they would be given their citizenship. This is something that has been written. There's been very little written about it by academics, very little written about it even in novels, because people don't like to talk about it. There was one man that I interviewed who told me, "We've never told our children, we've never told our grandchildren about what we did during the confession program because we aren't dead yet, so we aren't safe yet." So this is something that's still considered a tremendous secret and a terrible disgrace. Okay, so there you've got your layers of history. We're getting deeper. Two sisters who leave Shanghai in 1937 come to Los Angeles and arrange marriages. We've gotten some of that. Well, these are sisters. In Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I wrote about best friends for life. In Peony and Love, I wrote about three sister wives and this relationship through the generations between a grandmother, her daughter, and the granddaughter. But now I've written about sisters. Now, sisters, this is a unique relationship. All sibling relationships are. This is the longest, typically, the longest relationship we'll have in our lives. Your sister or your brother is the person you will know the longest time in your lifetime. I know. Isn't that just great? You know? And there are a lot of emotions that get attached to that. Your sister is the person who is supposed to stand by you and love you and support you no matter what. And yet it's also your sister who knows exactly where to drive the knife to hurt you the most. Now, I want you to know on my little piece of paper I wrote Psycho. You know, and I just think of that as like in the movie, there's Janet Leigh. She's minding her own business, taking a shower, right? And then here comes the guy, and that's your sister, right? So I was very curious about this difference between actual sisters and women who are so close, friends who are so close that they are just like sisters. And what is that difference? And how does that play out in our lives? Is there something that your sister could do? Is that me squeaking or is there something behind me? It's just I hear something. So, okay, if you don't hear it, then it's okay. They might have very large mice back there. So, it's my sister. Yeah. So sisters, and what's the difference? Now, earlier I had mentioned talking to people on the internet, and I had three book clubs that I met, two on the internet, or actually several on the internet. So I'm sorry. See, this is the first time I've done this, so I don't know what I'm talking about. One that I did with Barnes & Noble online. And this was for Peony and Love. Now, if you've ever done one of these Barnes & Noble book clubs, you're supposed to have a moderator. Our moderator never showed up. So, you know, I ask questions, they ask questions. This thing goes on for a month. And after about, you know, 8 days, we'd kind of run out of questions to ask each other. So at that point, I was really thinking about fate, fortune, and destiny. And was there a difference between these things? And so I just asked this group this on you know, online. And so we forgot all about Peony and Love, and we just talked about fate, fortune, and destiny. Now, I never met these women in person, but a lot of what they told me about their thoughts about fate, fortune, and destiny worked their way into the book, and one of those women is here tonight. When it's so fun to meet her. But there was another book club that I talked to that, and this was after months and months, and I join a lot of book clubs by speakerphone. You call me up, just hit the speakerphone and ask questions. We chit-chat for a while, and I love it because I don't have to get dressed up. I don't have to brush my hair, you know. I don't have to drive anywhere. I can talk to people all over the country. I've even done some in other countries. And at that point, I was really thinking about sisters. And I had an idea for how the book was going to end. I had known it all along. I always know the beginning, and I always know the end. I never know what's going to happen in the middle. So I'm, you know, I'd been writing towards this end, and that's how I've done every book. Know the beginning, know the end, writing towards it. And the closer I got to the end, the more uncomfortable I felt, because I had this thing that was going to happen. And I kept thinking, you know, if that was my sister, it just couldn't happen that way. If it was one of mine, I just couldn't let it happen that way. So I started asking people on these book clubs by speakerphone, you know, is there something your sister could do that would be irrevocable? Well, there's one thing. You all know what it is. Sleep with your husband, you know. But then people would write to me, so I didn't want to say it in front of the group. But I haven't spoken to my sister in 10 years because, and then, you know, I'd hear this whole long story. But nevertheless, even though I haven't spoken to her in 10 years, she's still my sister. And I know that she'll come around, even though I hate her guts right now. And I kept getting these stories and people coming up after events like this and saying, you know, I heard what you said about sisters and same thing. We haven't spoken now in 40 years, but now our parents are dying and now we have to. So sisters are for life. And that was the something that someone said in this book club. And I thought, yeah, that's right. Sisters are for life. So I did change the ending a bit. It's not a complete happy ending, I wouldn't say, but I did have to take that into consideration, something that I knew to be true. I am either an only child or one of four sisters. I have a former stepsister, Catherine, who I've now known for 50 years. I have two half-sisters who are different halves. One is my mother's daughter, the other is my father's daughter. One is 10 years younger, and one is 17 years younger. We have never lived in the same house together for any great length of time, which is probably a blessing. But nevertheless, we're sisters. And you know that in families there are certain things you can say. There's one who's the smartest, the thinnest, the one that mom likes the most or dad likes the most. Well, in our family, I'll admit it, I'm the thinnest. My sister Clara, she's the smartest, hands down. Catherine is the biggest troublemaker, no question. Ariana is the biggest hard luck story. But beyond all of that, I'm the oldest, right? I'm the oldest. So, as the oldest, what does that mean? I'm the one who's always right. Or at least I should be, but they always tell me I'm wrong. So, you know, I don't know how that works. Anyway, so sisters. And how is this different from this relationship that we have with a best friend? I do believe it's that sisters are forever, that blood is thicker than water. So finally, the deepest emotions. When I was working on this book, I'd gotten pretty far into it, and I was a live auction item for a library in Northern California in a town called Fairfield, which is the home of the Jelly Belly. And the live auction item was a group of women, I think a book club, would fly to Los Angeles. I would take them out for dim sum. I would give them some signed copies of my books, and then I would take them on a tour of Los Angeles Chinatown. And I said, oh, sure, I'll do it, because I thought they were never going to come. And guess what? Of course they came, right? They came. So we went out to lunch, and it was lovely. And then I gave them their books, and they were happy. And then we started on this tour. and I took them to first my great-grandfather's store. Now, my great-grandfather came from China. He had four wives. One was Caucasian, as you might have imagined. I come from what's called the first family, and then there's the second family, even though there were four wives. So here we were in the second family's store. And this store has now been in business for about 80 years. And the oldest son who has run that store for many, many years, he had just passed away. And now his oldest brother is running the store, and he's 78. And I thought, in 5 years, this is going to be gone. And then we walk down Chongqing Way to Fong's gift shop. Fong's gift shop was started by my great-grandfather's brother. And that store had been run for years and years and years by the youngest son in that family, who died about a year earlier. And now his oldest brother is running the store, and he actually just this year turned 98. And I thought, well, for sure, this is going to be gone in a few years, probably less than five. And then we got in the car, and we drove out to Pasadena to where the first family store, the store that is connected to my family. And this store, it was started in 1871. It's this huge Chinese antique store, much larger than this room. But it's divided up into little rooms. And I have a certain standard tour that I give. Oh, my God, I didn't realize it was so late. Okay, I'm going to wrap this up really fast. So a certain standard tour that I give. Over here is the big marriage bed. Over here is the big temple. And my great-grandparents, when they would go to China, they would go into villages and they'd say, we like your temple, we'll buy it. And my family had this very interesting way of running a business. Never sell anything. So, you know, so here's the big marriage bed. Here's the big temple. And on this side are these separate rooms. And one of them is the art room. And we walk into the art room, so I get talked about all those things, and we walk into the art room where I always have talked about my great-grandmother's dowry table, the table that the family had sat around and had all of their meals for, you know, 60, 70 years. And it was gone. And my cousin, who's been running the store for many, many years, has always said, Grandma's dowry table is the last thing I'll sell before I close the store. And in fact, it was the first. These women on the tour were having such a wonderful time, but I was just heartbroken because I realized in that 2 hours that all of the people and all of the places who have meant so much to me, who have made me who I am, who have given me the material that I write about, who have given me stories, that all of that is going to be gone in a couple of years. And I know I'm not the first person to go through that. We all go through that. I was giving a talk about a year ago in Capitola. And, well, that's right by Santa Cruz. So you'd think, you know, people would be kind of light and cheerful about things. But I was talking about this, and this woman, her name was Winky. She said, yeah, well, it's not going to get any better. I thought, well, you know, that's true. It's not, but I'm in it right now. And that feeling of loss for the people and places who make you who you are, that is at the heart, the emotional heart, that deepest layer in Shanghai Girls. I can barely talk about it. So I feel like I've taken everything that I know right up to this minute, and every emotion that I've experienced right up to this minute, to write Shanghai Girls, to write about love and loss and sisters and family. There's a Chinese artist from the Ming Dynasty who said, art is the heartbeat of the artist. This book, of all of my books, I think is closest to my heart, and I hope that it will speak to your heart as well. Or hearts, I guess you have more than one. Thank you. The Also, we can have some questions. They have microphones. If you raise your hand, they'll come by with a microphone because they're recording this. They'd like to have it on their, in the microphone. Don't be shy.
Lisa, I just want to say I don't think any of your generation will be lost because you're keeping it alive in your books, and we all thank you for that.
Thank you.
I'd just like to hear more about the difference between the first family and the second family, the way you described that.
Yeah, so the difference between the first family and the second family. My great-grandfather, well, actually, have people heard about my family before? Oh, well, okay, just settle back. I'll tell you a story. So my great-great-grandfather was actually the first person on the Chinese side to come to this country. He was an herbalist, and he came to work on the building of the Transcontinental Railroad. I like to think of this man as one of the original deadbeat dads. You were supposed to come here, work hard, save up your money, and send it back home to China. Not my great-great-grandfather. He had a fondness for women and gambling, something that continues in our family even today. And as a result, his wife, my great-great-grandmother, was so poor that she used to carry people on her back from village to village to support money, to earn money to support her children. Finally, people took pity on her and lent my great-grandfather, who was 14 years old, the money to come to the United States, what the Chinese called the Gold Mountain. By that time, the railroad was completed. He found his father working in Sacramento. He said, "You know, Dad, you're a bum. Go home." And he did. And my great-grandfather stayed, and he did a lot of the jobs that immigrants do even today. He washed dishes in restaurants. He swept up in factories. He worked in the fields. But by the time he was 30, in the 1880s, in Sacramento, he had his first business. It was a factory that manufactured crotchless underwear for brothels. Now, one day into his shop came a young woman who I think of as being quintessentially American. Her family had come out west. Are we in Pennsylvania? Yeah, from Pennsylvania. She'd come out west from Pennsylvania. I had to think about where Philadelphia was. And this is really bad because it's only day one of the tour. So they had come out west on the Oregon Trail in a covered wagon. We know so much more about what that American pioneer life was like and how hard it was. Her mother died when she was a baby. Her father died when she was 7. She was raised by brothers who were reputed to be quite cruel to her. When she turned 18, she ran away from home. She couldn't afford San Francisco, ended up in Sacramento, and it wasn't like it is today where if you're a young woman on your own and worse comes to worse, you could go work at a Starbucks or the 7-Eleven or Walmart. No one would hire her. I know she had one option for a job. As far as I know, she didn't take it. But she did end up going into Chinatown, begging my great-grandfather for a job, and he hired her to sell what they called in our family fancy underwear for fancy ladies. One thing led to another, and they decided to get married, but I use that term very loosely because in California, it was against the law for Chinese and Caucasians, Chinese down to a quarter Chinese, to marry in the state until 1948. Against the law in some other states, like Washington State, for example, till 1965. Against the law for Chinese to own property in California also until 1948. And against the law at the federal level for Chinese to become naturalized citizens until 1943. So for these two people to get married, what they did was they went to a lawyer who drew up a contract between two people as though they were forming a partnership. They eventually left Sacramento, moved down to Los Angeles, stayed in the underwear business for a while, gradually into antiques, this had started as an herb store, then underwear, then curios, then antiques, and that's what's still in business today. By 1919, my great-grandfather, he was the first Chinese in America to own an automobile. He had 5 stores, 5 children. He used to rent all that stuff that he would buy to the movies. So if you ever see an old movie, or even if you see a relatively recent movie with anything Chinese in it, it came from our family store. So, you know, from all the way from Broken Blossoms is Silent through The Good Earth, through The Joy Luck Club, I can just see that. So I says, oh, yeah, I know that. Oh, yeah, I know that's over here. That, you know, so all that stuff. And anyway, they decided to go back to China on a buying trip. And while he was there, I think he realized that as high as he had gone here, he was only going to get so far. He couldn't be legally married to his wife. His kids couldn't go to regular American school. And he started buying up just different kinds of businesses, a factory that made firecrackers, another one for baskets, another one for porcelains. In the home village, a village of about 300 people, he built the house he couldn't have in Los Angeles. It was 1919. So just imagine a sort of beautiful Spanish-style mansion beamed across the Pacific like Star Trek and dropped into this little village of even today only has 300 people. The problem with having all of that there was he needed someone to take care of it. He thought that person should be my grandfather, Eddie, who was only 14 years old. Ticey didn't want to split up the family. She packed up the kids, came back to L.A., didn't think too much about it, but a few months later intercepted a letter, took it to a letter reader in Chinatown, and found out that her husband, who was in his 60s, had just married a 16-year-old girl. That's where you get the second family. And that gets you to page about 125 in On Gold Mountain. And you can tell that I have told that story a lot of times, whereas talking about Shanghai Girls, I haven't. Because I know this one really, really well, because I've told it a lot. So there were two families. They did separate at that point. They lived across the street from each other for many, many years. The second wife, Apo, she always treated the first wife as the first wife and would send over lunch and you know, be very respectful as a proper second Chinese wife should. That she actually only died a couple of years ago. She lived to be 98. He died in 1957, and she was... I guess now she's been dead a while. But he died in 57, and she was only 40, and she had not yet been outside on the streets in Los Angeles. Pearl and May in Shanghai Girls, they come to Los Angeles in arranged marriages, and we had a lot of arranged marriages in my family. My great uncle, the one I told you about, had the shop. Back in 1932, he took his whole family back to China. You know, a lot of dads would say, here's a little money, go buy a souvenir. He said, you know, as long as we're here, let's get all you boys' wives. And that's what they did. And the oldest one was about 25, the youngest one was about 14. And these girls came over, and they thought they were marrying Gold Mountain men, these men who lived not only in California, but in Hollywood. They thought they were going to live this glamorous life. They had had servants in China. They became the servants when they got here. And they lived these very, very closed-in lives. They didn't get out. They weren't allowed out. Some of them, well, now almost all of them are dead, but some of them now have been here for, what is that, you know, 70, 80 years, and they may speak 10 words of English. They just didn't get out. So I really wanted to write about that experience. But anyway, that's how you got the two families. There's the first family that comes down through Fong Si and Ticey Pruitt, family from Pennsylvania, and the second family, which was with his one of three Chinese wives.
In Snowflower, you talk about the foot binding. We know.
Where are you?
What? Right here.
Oh,
hi.
Okay.
Hi.
Hi.
That's the book I've read from you, and I really enjoyed it. And when I saw your picture, I was very shocked to see that you weren't Chinese. So,
I get that a lot.
Yeah, I can imagine. So I was wondering how you gathered that information, because that when I read that book, that was something that I never knew about and was shocking to read, and I was very interested on that aspect of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I did the usual kinds of research that anyone could do in a great library like this. You just do the research, you know, and I read dissertations, things that people don't really read. I talked to scholars, but also for Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I did travel to Jianyang County in southwestern Hunan province. I was told I was only the second foreigner ever to go there. By my count, I was the fifth. And, you know, there's some upsides and downsides to going to a place that's that remote. Some of the upsides are it's like you're stepping back in time, right? It's like it could be 100 years ago, 300 years ago, because life is pretty much the same. And it's beautiful and it's pristine and quiet. Some of the downsides are you eat what they give you. So if dinner is pig penis, you just... It is not so bad. It really isn't. It's just like chicken. But it is a little more chewy. So while I was there, I got to meet the old, at that time, the oldest living Nushu writer. She was about 96 when I interviewed her, and she died about 3 months later. She was just this, you know, tiny, 96, very shrunken, tiny little woman. She'd lost most of her hair. Her skin was like tissue paper. She had bound feet. She could no longer buy bound foot shoes. They didn't have them in her village. She could no longer make them because her hands were so crippled by arthritis. She wore child-sized kung fu slippers with tissues stuffed in the toes because she couldn't buy proper shoes. And she talked to me about the whole process for her and what it had been like, and certainly the care that she had had to give them throughout her life. I mean, the process of foot binding lasts 2 years, but you have them for the rest of your life, and you have to take care of those feet. It's a very hot and humid. Just imagine the worst summer day here in Philadelphia. I was here on a day like that several years ago, you know, where it's like the windows are dripping. And it's like that in China. I mean, it's really like, you know, very hot, very humid. So imagine having this foot all wrapped up on itself, being wrapped in these long layers of binding cloth for days on end. Things get a little nasty in there. And so you have to take care of them. And so, you know, you're always watching out that you don't get gangrene. Toes were always sort of rotting and falling off. Because the bones had been broken throughout your life, the bones could break through the skin. So, you know, you'd have to sand down these bones. This is all stuff I didn't even write about. You know, but I go to places and I do the research. And I was just in China to do research for the next book. And I was in Shanghai at the beginning and in Beijing at the end. But in the middle, I was staying in a very small village. Again, there was an upper and lower village. The lower village had about 300 people and the upper village had about 500 in a 17th century house with 29 bedrooms. Doesn't that sound glamorous? It's not like Italy. I will just say that, because there were no windows. No heat, and the high when I was there was 48 degrees. No indoor plumbing and no hot water. So the 29 bedrooms were lovely, but I just could not have been more cold. You know, but you go and you find out things, and I think I strayed from your question about foot binding.
Research. Obviously, is that better? Okay, you do a lot of research, and I think that's why I mentioned this in one of the emails, that your books are so, I don't know, your characters are so real, and I think it's because there's so much substance to them. But anyhow, on the research aspect, how do you know what to include? What do you do with the other information? Does your editor have a lot of input that way, or do you just know how to reel yourself in? How do you stop yourself? Because I'm sure there's so much more to know and learn and read.
And well, I don't stop myself because I am a research fanatic. In some ways, it's my favorite part of the process because you never know what you're going to find. You just don't know it. I know there are writers who hire people to do it. I could never do that because how are they going to know the thing that's going to make me think, oh, my God, I've got to use that. That's just amazing. I've got to use that. And I over-research. I mean, people tell me I over-research, and I do. I over-research because I really like it. And in the first draft, there's so much in there that I end up taking out. I think my editor, I think I've actually had a lot of editors who've said over the years, you know, it's about the people. It's not about, you know, like I, speaking of Snowflower and the Secret Fan, that woman, that old woman's daughter came in and they taught me, they showed me how to make bound foot shoes and how to make wedding quilts. And I had a whole chapter about making wedding quilts and making foot binding shoes. But really that story, I mean, that chapter was about Beautiful Moon dying. That's what that chapter was about. So it was all in there, how to make a wedding quilt, how to make the whole process of making foot binding, you know, bound foot shoes. But I just peeled all of that out until all they're doing is just a little embroidery, I think. Because it's about the girls and about this terrible tragedy that's about to happen and what happens in the aftermath. I think, and I don't know if it's true, but I think that all of that is underneath. You know, that you, I mean, I hope that you know or you're feeling as readers, oh, yeah, there's, you know, she knows what she's talking about, that it's under there, you know, that it's under there, that you might not learn how to make a wedding quilt or how to make bound foot shoes, but you know, I know about it. So, you know, you could assume that maybe I would know about it. And I think that just gives it, it's like the foundation. It's just under there. But it's, you know, there are things that I find that I just think, oh, this is so cool, I've got to use it. And then later I just think, okay, well, that was cool to me, but this is about sisters, or this is about what's going to happen with Sam, the husband, or what's going to happen with the daughter. That's what really matters, is how do we connect to characters, whether they're real or imagined, right? It's that connect in reading, for me, maybe not for you, but in reading, that's what I connect to. It's what happens to these people, whether they are real or imagined, what's happening in their hearts, and by extension, you're really connecting to the human condition. From my perspective, I mean, that's just for me as a reader. I don't know if that happens to you, but that's what I want in a book, and that's what I try to get at it with my own books. I don't know if I'm successful, but that's what I aspire to. Okay, one more question. You guys have to duke it out to see who gets it.
This actually isn't a question, but just a thank you. You did speak to my book club on the telephone, and I just want to thank you because I saw it in Real Simple and emailed you, and indeed we had this back-and-forth email conversation, and it was a wonderful thing, and it really added a dimension to the understanding of the book and to our book club. So anybody else that can try and do that, it was great. Thank you.
Well, you're most welcome.
And since it wasn't a question,
may I? Thank you.
Sneaky. That was very sneaky.
No, Con. kind. I'm very curious about your knowledge of the Chinese dialects when you're interviewing people.
Mm-hmm.
Are you fluent in many of them, in any of them?
No. So how fluent am I in Chinese dialects? I grew up in a Cantonese-speaking family. Someone earlier said I didn't look too Chinese. Well, in Los Angeles, I have about 400 relatives. About a dozen look like me. The majority are still full Chinese in this spectrum in between. And certainly when I was little, there were a lot of people who only spoke the Tse-Yep dialect. So I understand food. That's it. Just food. Just food. That, and you know what? That really does show I'm Chinese, because it's just all about the food. I studied Mandarin for 4 years. And I got pretty good. So. You know, and I could go and I could get around, certainly. But when I go and I'm on a research trip, I always hire someone who speaks that local dialect. So this trip that I just did, I started in Shanghai, and, well, I might as well just tell you this because this is just so cool. I was with Amy Tan, and I usually go by myself, but Amy said, I have to go do a trip, you know, let's do it. I have to do a research trip too. Let's do it together. I was like, oh, okay, you know, how cool is this? And so it was like a 2-week pajama party kind of thing. It was just fabulous. And you know, we did get to know each other really well because there was no hot water and no indoor plumbing. So here's the really neat part. So she has those sisters who live in China, right? And two of them are there in Shanghai. And so she said, oh, well, let's just ask Jindo to come to the village with us. I was like, sure, let's have Jindo come to the village. What do I do? Sure, more the merrier. And so because Jindo will be able to translate for us. So this village was in Anhui Province. Anhui Province is where Pearl Buck used to write a lot about Anhui. That's where Good Earth takes place. And but it's only where we were going was only 250 miles from Shanghai. And Jindo could not understand a word. Not a word. She was just totally useless. But she's a very good singer. So she sang to us, and that was a lot of fun. But when I'm, you know, so then we did, and I had said, I'm all for Jindo, but, you know, I'll just pay to have my own translator because you need to, you know, you have to have someone who knows that local dialect. With Snowflower and the Secret Fan, I was walking that one. I was by myself and a translator, walking from village to village. And these villages were like, a half a mile apart. So what is that? A 10-minute walk, a 20-minute walk. Even today, the dialect changes from village to village. And so in that area, it was a closed area of China. So I also, in that area, had someone who was like the vice mayor with us. So we'd be walking village to village. And it was a good thing we had him with us because written Chinese is standard. It doesn't matter whether it's, you know, Cantonese or Mandarin or the Wu dialect from Shanghai or any of these little tiny village dialects, the written language is standard. So there'd be a lot of time talking to people, just writing on our palms with our fingers, do you mean this character or this character? And that's something you see a lot more in China today because people are traveling and moving around a lot more than they used to. Thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.